tonight. An extraordinary moment in a war at a crossroads.
1 year later, Kyiv stands and Ukraine stands. Democracy stands.
The President of the United States on an unprecedented and dangerous trip into Ukraine. As Russia's invasion nears 1 year of barbarism and bloodshed.
This conversation brings us closer to victory.
President Biden's visit to Kyiv, a defiant rebuke of Vladimir Putin. As the world asks, when will this war end? How far will the U.S. and allies go to defend a democracy on the brink? And what will Putin do next in his unprovoked attack on a sovereign state?
Russia's aim was to wipe Ukraine off the map. Putin's war of conquest is failing.
We want to welcome our viewers here in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer, and this is a special edition of the Situation Room. President Biden's back in Poland tonight after a day that will go down in history, preparing for another momentous day tomorrow when he and Vladimir Putin will be delivering dueling addresses nearly 800 miles apart. President Biden traveled under a cloak of secrecy to the capital of Ukraine early this morning, the city that Russia thought it would be able to capture right at the start of its invasion, but Kyiv still stands almost 1 year into this war. And what a dramatic show of solidarity to see President Biden standing alongside President Volodymyr Zelensky in broad daylight, right in the heart of a democracy under attack, with a very audible reminder of the extreme danger that exists around them. The surprise trip coming on the eve of a speech by Putin to his nation, attempting to justify a second year of bloodshed.
Putin's war of conquest is failing. He thought he could outlast us. I don't think he's thinking that right now.
So how will the Russian leader respond to President Biden only hours from now? We have team coverage coming up. We'll go live to Fred Pleitgen. He's in Moscow this hour. Caitlin Collins is live in Warsaw, where the president just arrived. Clarissa Ward is live in Kyiv. Sam Kiley is joining us from Kharkiv. But first, let's go to Jim Sciutto for more on how this very, very secret trip came together. Jim, what are you learning?
Wolf, it's a complicated journey from the U.S. Capitol to the Ukrainian Capitol. It began on Sunday morning at 4:15 a.m. here in Washington, with stops at Ramstein Air Base in Germany for refueling, another stop then at a Polish air base, the rest of the journey to Kyiv on a train from Poland to the Ukrainian capital. We should note the U.S. gave a heads up to Russia in advance, this not for Russia's convenience, in effect a warning, do not fire on the Ukrainian capital while the U.S. president is there. We should also note that U.S. air assets were deployed right up to the Polish border, careful not to cross into Ukrainian airspace. They did not want to come into conflict with Russian military resources there, but close enough, both for overwatch, for the president's safety, and also in the event that there was an attack and the president was injured in some way, they would have the ability to evacuate him and quickly. I should note that of the president's small team, there was also a medical team traveling with President Biden. That final leg on a train from Poland to Kyiv, an unusual train trip for a president known as Amtrak Joe for all his trips back and forth from here to Jet, Delaware. But this is the path into Kyiv that world leaders, U.S. officials and others have used. The safest, not the fastest route to Kyiv from Poland, but the safest route in.
It's a 10-hour train ride. Not short at all. Stand by, Jim. Let me get back to you. I want to go to CNN anchor Caitlin Collins. She's joining us from the Polish capital of Warsaw right now, where President Biden just arrived. Caitlin, you're also, I understand, getting some new information on the president's visit. Update our viewers.
Well, Wolf, this had been a trip that they had really been planning for months. Of course, initially, the public schedule that the White House put out had President Biden coming to Warsaw first. As we all know now, that did not happen. There was that detour to Kyiv as he left the White House, as Jim was noting there, in the early hours of Sunday morning, traveling with the shades down on Air Force One, also traveling with the shades down on the train that he was taking to Kyiv once he had gotten to Poland and was going into Ukraine. And it was something that they had been planning for months. But instead of typically going into large groups of staff throughout the agencies inside the administration, only a few people were told about this, Wolf, because obviously it was so sensitive and so closely held that it was not something that could be shared widely for planning. And it was last Friday that the president gathered in the Oval Office with his top aides and made the final decision to go to Kyiv. He was presented essentially with security options, what the risks were, what this would look like, and he made the final decision to go. And Jake Sullivan, his national security advisor, was essentially describing that as he believed that, yes, there was a risk, but he believed that risk was worth taking because of the message that he was going to be sending by going into Ukraine just days before that one-year anniversary. And I think the idea that they did give the Kremlin a heads up, just a few hours a heads up, that he would be coming into Ukraine is notable. That is not some kind of diplomatic nod from the United States to Russia. That instead was for deconfliction purposes, which essentially means to avoid the possibility of an unintentional or intentional Russian strike. That was for the president's safety, why they told them that. Wolf.
Caitlin, President Biden and Russian President Putin, as you well know, are set to give these dueling speeches tomorrow, just ahead of the one-year anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So what message do you expect President Biden to deliver, given that we actually heard him call out Putin directly earlier today?
He did. He challenged him directly, saying basically he got it wrong. What he thought was going to happen has not happened. That does not mean they're in this ideal scenario. Obviously, there is still a war, a brutal war that is waging in Ukraine. But talking about just how far Putin's expectations have fallen from what he thought was going to happen just a year ago. And Wolf, you and I were here in Warsaw 11 months ago, listening to President Biden speak in the same place that he's actually going to be speaking tomorrow. And that was when he made that comment about Putin, saying he cannot remain in power. Of course, still a feeling that the president shares today. But what you're going to see on display tomorrow is President Putin will speak first. Then you will hear from President Biden hours later. It will be two vastly different worldviews, autocracy versus democracy, this theme that you have seen President Biden return to time and time again. That is going to be more of what he's saying tomorrow. But underneath all of that, there will still be questions about what other support the U.S. is prepared to provide to Ukraine. You've seen what they've called for, what was not delivered there today. Those are going to be the big questions coming out of those two dueling speeches tomorrow night. It will be a remarkable split screen, though.
It certainly will. And Caitlin, I'm so glad you're there in Warsaw covering all of this for us. Right now, I want to bring back Jim Sciutto. He's got more. So, Jim, how does this latest round of what, $500 million in U.S. military assistance to Ukraine fit in with the bigger picture, the billions that have already been provided?
Well, let's look at the headline figure. So far since the start of the war, close to $30 billion. It's a big headline figure. But when you place it in the context of the overall U.S. defense budget in 2023, $816 billion. That means the aid to Ukraine, and we're speaking specifically here of military assistance, amounts to less than 4% of the overall U.S. defense budget. And U.S. officials have made the point, for that 4%, the U.S. has contributed to really the decimation of Russia's ground military capability. Let's get into what is the bulk of that aid. A lot of it's ammunition. I mean, 102 million artillery rounds. I was told that Ukraine is firing in a day what it takes the U.S. about 2 weeks to make. I mean, that is the pace of the war at this point. A whole host of anti-tank systems. They had enormous effect, particularly in the early stages of the war, neutralizing Russia's advantage in heavy armor. More recently, the focus has shifted to vehicles. And I want to draw attention to a couple categories of those. We know the effect the HIMARS, the howitzers, highly accurate artillery and rocket systems have had striking Russian forces even far behind lines. More recently, the focus on Abrams tanks. We're also seeing Leopard tanks coming from Europe and other partners, Bradley fighting vehicles. Why these now? These give Ukrainian forces the ability not just to defend territory, but also, they hope, to take territory back. There's an enormous amount of hope among Ukrainian military leaders right now that with these weapons, Stryker vehicles from the U.S. as well, they'll be able to push back against the Russians and take back some of the territory taken in since the first, first year now of this invasion.
Yeah, impressive amount of arsenal, impressive amount indeed so far, and it's presumably going to get even much, much bigger. Jim, stand by for us. I want to go down to the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv, where our chief international correspondent, Clarissa Ward, is standing by for us. Clarissa, despite this new infusion of U.S. and allied military assistance, the Ukrainians are still pleading and pleading and pleading for more. What can you tell us about that?
Well, they see what's coming on the horizon with this Russian offensive, and they want to be prepared for it. They don't want this to turn into a protracted stalemate, and they know that in order to try to precipitate some kind of victory, they say they need long-range artillery, fighter jets, things of this nature. Now, we did hear President Zelensky's chief of staff, Andrei Yermak, today allude to the fact that potentially some kind of agreement or some kind of movement was happening with the White House and Bankova on that. He said issues are being resolved and those that were stuck have been sped up. We don't know specifically what he was talking about there, but as mentioned, these more heavier weaponry are exactly what they have been looking for, what they have been asking for. In the short term, though, the most desperately needed thing here in Ukraine militarily is ammunition. According to CNN's own reporting, Ukrainians have been burning through ammunition, particularly in the east of the country in Bakhmut, at such a rate that the U.S. and NATO have not been able to produce it fast enough to replenish it. So we did see today a guarantee of a lot of ammunition coming this way. That will be greatly received. But now the next question becomes, how can they push to extract that heavier weaponry that's more difficult for the U.S. to agree to? We have seen the U.K. agree in principle to start training Ukrainian pilots on U.K. fighter jets, although they then did sort of row that back and qualify it by saying that it could take years. And that's the real concern, Wolf, for Ukrainian officials, is that they don't have years.
Yeah, they don't. All right, Clarissa, stand by. We'll get back to you. I want to get back to Jim Sciutto right now, take a closer look at the next phase of this war. We're anticipating Russia's spring offensive to begin as the weather gets better. So what can we expect from Putin's next move?
Well, the focus of the fighting in recent weeks has been here along the Eastern Front. And really, they become the killing fields of Eastern Ukraine. The casualties on both sides, staggering, sometimes many hundreds a day, both Russian forces and Ukrainian forces. Why? A hailstorm of artillery fire back and forth, rocket fire back and forth along this frontier with minimal gains, sometimes measured in yards per day. Now, the focus in recent weeks has been discussion of a Russian offensive, a spring offensive. You've heard a lot of advertisements of this, particularly from the Russian side, but the U.S. military view of this, I've spoken to U.S. military officials about the U.S. assessment of Russian capabilities, is that that offensive is more aspirational than realistic, because though Russia has amassed a large number of forces here, they don't have the quality of forces, the training, and they don't have the equipment to gain serious ground, perhaps for another several months. At the same time, Ukraine believes they have an opportunity now to push in this direction and perhaps even crucially cross this border with those weapons we've been discussing, the Stryker vehicles, the Bradley fighting vehicles, and tanks such as the Abrams and the Leopards from Germans and other NATO allies, to not just defend this frontier, but take back territory already taken from Russia. It's going to be a brutal, deadly fighting season. The Ukrainians think they have the advantage.
Jim Sciutto reporting for us. Jim, thank you very much. Just ahead, so what happens if China joins in on this Ukraine invasion? President Zelensky offering a very, very grave warning to the world tonight. How worried is the United States about talk of World War III? We'll ask President Biden's Deputy National Security Advisor. Standing by live. Stay with us. You're in the Situation Room. Mounting concern tonight that China may increase its support of Russia by arming it with lethal weapons. As U.S. officials warned China that doing so would cross a red line, Ukrainian President Zelensky raised another alarm that China's involvement would risk what the president of Ukraine calls World War III. The geopolitical fault lines deepened further as China's top diplomat traveled to Russia today while President Biden touched down in Ukraine. Let's get some insight right now from a White House insider who was directly involved in planning President Biden's unprecedented, very dangerous trip to Kyiv. John Feiner is joining us. He serves as principal deputy national security advisor to the president. John, thanks so much for joining us on this historic, very busy day. We'll get to China in a moment, but let me start with the president's historic trip to Kyiv today. The planning took I understand months, but the president only made the final decision to go on Friday. How did he make the decision to visit what's clearly an active war zone?
That's right, Wolf. The president had been briefed on the plan as it came together over a period of months. And again, in recent weeks, he went through all the details down to the kind of minute of each movement, each meeting that would take place, and how the security team and others involved in conducting the trip were going to think about and manage risk. On Friday, he gathered with his senior White House staff and with his National Security Cabinet, Secretary of State, his Secretary of Defense, intelligence officials, and talked to the group about the prospect of going ahead with the trip, and ultimately decided to do so, believed the risk was manageable, and believed the message that it would send of solidarity and support for the people of Ukraine was well worth going ahead. And, you know, when you conduct a trip like this, you can plan perfectly. But in an active war zone, there are always things that can go wrong or unknown factors that hadn't been taken into account. We were very gratified that everything went as well as it did today.
Was there anyone, John, who was actually advising him not to go? I asked the question because as a former White House correspondent myself, I know the U.S. Secret Service is always nervous about wherever the president of the United States goes.
So one thing I think that I take seriously and is a real privilege about being involved in these discussions is you don't then walk out in front of the TV cameras and talk about who came down on which side of the argument. Ultimately, everyone was comfortable with the president proceeding, and he is the ultimate decision maker, made the decision to go ahead.
What was the decision? Why did you guys make a decision to inform the Russians of the president's trip in advance of it becoming public knowledge?
It was something that we discussed for a while in advance of the trip, and ultimately the decision was made that with security and safety being the utmost priority, we were better off letting the Russians know so that they could deconflict anything that they were contemplating, because we didn't want them to misperceive any unusual activity, treat it in the wrong way. So that was the decision that was made. We conveyed that information just before the president departed, and again, everything went more or less as planned.
In regards to China right now, this is a huge issue. You heard President Zelensky's warning today that China's support for Russia with lethal weapons could lead to a third world war. Does the White House, John, share those fears?
Well, look, leaving aside that ultimate worst case scenario, we have been quite clear that we ourselves have mounting concerns about Chinese support for Russia's war efforts. Secretary Blinken spoke to this earlier in the week. And look, China is to some extent trying to have it both ways. They are making a public presentation about the desire to play a role in diplomacy to try to end the war. Meanwhile, we have concerns that they may be actually increasing their support to Russia. I think our strong view is if China is actually interested in ending the war, they should talk to the Ukrainians, consult with the Ukrainians about what their requirements would be for the war to end, and not funneling increasing amounts of support potentially to Russia, which could stop this war at any moment if it desired to do that.
What action, John, is the Biden administration willing to take if China offers lethal support to Russia?
Look, we don't want to get ahead of any decisions. We've been quite clear about our concerns. We have options available to us, but we're not about to sort of lay them out in advance of conversations that we have with the Chinese, that we have with the Ukrainians, and that we have with our partners and allies who very much share the concerns that we've spoken about publicly during the course of recent weeks.
We've seen how this war has shifted the U.S. position on military aid to Ukraine, ramping up to include the Patriot air defense missile system, and now a commitment to send battle tanks. Is sending F-16 fighter jets or longer range missiles also a possibility?
The president has spoken to this, and I'm not going to elaborate on his comments. But what I will say is we have made decisions about security assistance at every phase of this conflict that have been tailored to what we believe the Ukrainians needed to be successful on the battlefield in that moment. Early in the war, that was Stinger anti-aircraft systems, that was anti-tank rounds, Javelin systems, and that enabled the Ukrainians to fend off an assault on their capital, where the Russians were trying to take over the entire country. That shifted into more of an artillery war in the east, and we have been providing enormous amounts of artillery so the Ukrainians could compete with the Russians, who have enormous amounts themselves during that phase of the conflict. More recently, it's been armored vehicles, tanks, as you mentioned, but also armored personnel carriers, infantry fighting vehicles for the next phase of the war, where the Ukrainians would like to go on the offensive themselves later this spring. We are working with them to get the equipment to do that. We are training them on the best way to go about that. And every phase of this is tailored to what we think their operational needs are, and that's going to continue.
While I have you, I want to get your thoughts on this. The U.S. today joined more than 30 countries to call on the International Olympic Committee to reverse its decision last month to enable Russian and Belarusian athletes to join the upcoming Olympic Games. Why was it important for the United States to take this stance?
Look, I will let the decision of the U.S. Olympic Committee speak for itself. It's not a policy decision that comes before the White House, so it wouldn't be appropriate for me to offer a view on it, but certainly nothing to contradict anything that they've decided.
But do you support that decision?
I have to look at it more carefully, honestly, before just going out and commenting on it.
John Finer, thank you very, very much. I know it's an incredibly busy day today. Thanks for joining us. We'll continue this conversation for sure down the road. Up next, what will Vladimir Putin say tomorrow after being upstaged by President Biden today? We're live in Moscow with the Russian leader's plans to address his people, taking on even more importance right now. And the first and only Ukrainian-born member of the U.S. Congress with her view on whether the U.S. is doing enough to help her home country. Stay with us. You're in the Situation Room. Welcome back to a special edition of the Situation Room. Tonight, we're awaiting reaction from Russia after President Biden's historic visit to Ukraine. Our senior international correspondent, Fred Plykin, is joining us from Moscow right now. He's got details. Fred, we're expecting to hear directly from Putin tomorrow. What do you anticipate? Mm-hmm.
Hi there, Wolf. Well, one of the interesting things about today is that from the Kremlin, we actually heard absolutely nothing about President Biden's visit to Kiev. We thought that possibly the Kremlin would react, but there was absolutely nothing. And I think one of the reasons for that is that obviously the Russians are gearing up towards that Vladimir Putin speech that is going to happen only in about 7 hours from now. And I can tell you from being on the ground here, there's a lot of people in Russian politics who do believe that that is going to be a very important speech. And that is one that is probably going to set the stage on how the Russians continue what they call their special military operation. Now, as far as President Biden's visit, though, of course, it was everywhere on Russian media throughout the entire course of the day. And of course, there were other officials who did comment on it. One of the things that they played on was the fact that obviously the White House, as has been mentioned on the show, informed the Russians before President Biden went. There were some Russian officials who criticized that, or some military bloggers who criticized that, but also some Russian officials who said that it showed that President Biden needed security guarantees. One of them is Dmitry Medvedev, the former president of this country. I want to read you a quote from him. He said, quote, "Biden, having received security guarantees in advance, finally went to Kiev, and here it is important to know that the West already delivers weapons and money to Kiev quite regularly in huge quantities, allowing the military-industrial complex of NATO countries to earn money and steal weapons to sell to terrorists around the world." So you can see some pretty harsh words there from the former Russian president. But this is really a narrative that the Kremlin has been putting out there, essentially saying, look, they're not only fighting against Ukraine, but they believe that they're also fighting against NATO and specifically the United States, Wolf.
Are there any signs at all, Fred, any signs at all that Putin may be backing down or looking for some sort of exit ramp?
Well, there is right now that there certainly isn't at all. And that's certainly one of the reasons one of the things that we also expect to hear in that speech from Vladimir Putin. Being on the ground here, speaking to people who are in Russian politics, in Russian media, Russian commentators, none of them believe that right now Vladimir Putin is anywhere near backing down. In fact, it seems as though he is doubling down. One of the things that the Russians still seem to believe is they think that they can outlast the Ukrainians, but that they can also outlast the support that the Ukrainians Ukrainians are getting from the U.S. and especially the U.S.'s European allies. So look for the speech tomorrow to be quite a harsh one, one in which Vladimir Putin tries to rally this nation behind what he calls the special military operation, where he's going to double down on that. And the Russians certainly also do believe that that offensive that seems to be shaping up in the east of Ukraine by those Russian forces, that that is something that will happen, but not necessarily something that will happen in a fast way. They think it could be a slow-moving thing, and that just with the fact that there are so many Russians that they can mobilize, that they could, in effect, overwhelm the Ukrainian forces that are on the ground there in the long term, because, again, they believe that they are simply in it for longer than the Ukrainians could hold out. But definitely look for a very, very harsh speech from Vladimir Putin tomorrow, and certainly Vladimir Putin showing absolutely no signs of backing down or of wanting to compromise in any way, Wolf.
All right, Fred, thank you very much. Fred Plotkin live in Moscow. Appreciate it. Let's continue the discussion right now with Republican Congresswoman Victoria Spartz. She's the first and only Ukrainian-born member of the U.S. Congress. Congresswoman, thanks so much for joining us. I know you've been back to Ukraine many times since this brutal war began a year ago. What message does this send for the President of the United States, President Biden, to make this risky trip to Kyiv?
Well, I think it was very important, even though I disagree with a lot of things with President Biden, but I think it's very important. It's very tough war. American people spend a lot of money. A lot of Ukrainians are dying. It's a very brutal war. I think for the President of the United States to go there and to show our support, it was very important. I think, you know, it's been politicized, this war, a lot, and I hope President Biden does other things that is going to be uniting our Congress and our country, because we have a lot of politics and Ukraine get dragged into politics. It's not very healthy, because I truly believe, you know, American people support this, you know, efforts what Ukrainian people are doing on a bipartisan basis, and too much politics hurts our efforts.
As you know, a small number of your Republican colleagues actually criticized President Biden's trip to Kyiv today, arguing he should be more focused on problems here at home, like the border or the Ohio toxic derailment issue. What do you say to those Republican colleagues of yours?
Well, I think, you know, these issues are not mutually exclusive. I think we have some very serious issues that we need to deal in our foreign policy agenda. We also have some internal issues, including border security. And I hope President Biden will try to find common ground with Republicans to deal with it, because it's a serious situation. We actually have our Judiciary Committee going to the border in a few days and try to get attention. So I think if President Biden wants to start governing and start doing politics, he needs to deal with both of this issue. Otherwise, it will be very divisive, and I don't think we should be divided. It's really very harmful for our country, what we have right now. We have a lot of drama, a lot of circus, a lot of politics, but I think governing countries really need of governing.
President Biden today announced an additional $500 million in new U.S. military assistance to Ukraine. We're talking about ammunition and other weapons. Do you believe the U.S. needs to start providing fighter jets to Ukraine?
Well, I think, you know, we also, you know, we need to provide whatever it takes for Ukrainian people and Ukrainian military, which is amazing, brave and tough. A lot of young people are fighting brutal battle, whatever it takes for them to win. You know, we shouldn't say like, we're not going to do this, or we're not going to provide this. We shouldn't even like tweet about what we're providing. We need to help the Ukrainian people to win this war. And we need to make sure that we do it promptly and proactively. We're doing much better now than we did a year ago. But I think if we're more proactive, it saves a lot of lives, and it saves a lot of money for American people too.
At the same time, Congresswoman, and I've taken a look at some of your public statements in recent weeks and months, you've been calling for more accountability. You're also pushing for the U.S. to deliver assistance much faster to Ukraine. So how do you balance that accountability as well as delivering military assistance quickly?
Well, I think proper accountability actually will streamline logistics and make sure that actually the aid does get to the right people, to the front lines, because Ukraine is a very complicated country with a lot of infiltration, potential sabotage, a lot of corruption, and a lot of people, you know, that can take advantage of the situation. But it's also have a lot of very brave people fighting for freedoms. So the more efficient logistic is, the better system we have set up, the more oversight we have in reporting back to Congress and to the American people, the more successful we're going to be in this effort. And I think efficiency is going to bring us better results. So I think better oversight, it will make us much more efficient and more strategic and have better policies. So I think Congress needs to request it, and on a bipartisan basis. And I truly, I'll be honest with you, Republicans and Democrats did a lot of work to put pressure on this administration to become better and more efficient on what aid we're supplying to Ukraine, because ultimately it's a reflection of the American people.
But you've expressed some concern in the past about corruption in Ukraine. Is that right?
Well, I did. And I think, you know, it's like, listen, you know, I was very surprised to see that actually this is my constitutional duty to make sure that regardless who is in charge, Republican or Democrat, we have oversight of the money that we're spending. And I was very surprised to see that I got criticized from both sides of the aisle, because that was the job we have to do. And I think putting pressure on actually the administration, it made us much better. I think we need to do more. We've seen what's happening. Ukraine has a lot of problems with corruption. I've noticed that a lot of people that have been involved in corruption didn't have any consequences of them doing what they're doing. And it's actually demoralizing for the Ukrainian people, the brave people that are dying for freedoms. And I think we should put pressure to make sure that they have democratic institutions functioning and make sure that, you know, they're not going to steal their money and then ask us for more money. That will be very important for us to have it, so we have a long-term support of this effort.
Congresswoman Victoria Spartz, thank you so much for joining us. We'll continue this conversation as well. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
So what does it mean for those who still call Ukraine home to see the leader of the free world standing with their president in Kyiv? CNN talks to Ukrainians, including one woman going through an especially painful moment in this war, as our special report continues. Stay with us. You're in the Situation Room.
Freedom is priceless. It's worth fighting for as long as it takes. And that's how long we're going to be with you, Mr. President, for as long as it takes.
We'll do it.
For many everyday Ukrainians, President Biden's unprecedented visit to Kyiv is a welcome show of support after nearly a year of suffering under Russia's brutal invasion. Our senior international correspondent, Sam Kiley, is joining us right now from Kharkiv in Ukraine, in the war zone there, with details. Sam, what are Ukrainians telling you about the president's trip? What's the reaction?
Well, Wolf, I've just come from an area of villages near the town of Kupiansk, which is very, very close indeed to the front line. Indeed, the villages there are getting pounded on a pretty regular and increasingly intense level. And the reaction there was, first of all, and we were speaking to people as Joe Biden's arrival in Kyiv was being made official and public knowledge just before he was meeting, or as his meetings got underway with President Zelensky. People were, if they were cognizant, were really focused on getting aid. They were being distributed a limited amount of international aid, a lot of it donated by the Buffett or a Buffett Foundation. But this, though, was very kind of moving in a sense, because for many people living near the front line, the war is so raw, it's very difficult for them to focus at all on the grand politics. This was the reaction of one elderly woman there.
Did you know that President Biden is in Kyiv today? The American president just arrived in Kyiv today.
I did hear yesterday that he was coming, that it would be Lukashenko, Putin and Biden, right? Or who? I saw this on TV yesterday, that they'll be meeting.
No, they're not meeting, but he's come to show solidarity with Ukraine. He's meeting with Zelensky today. What do you think of that? Watch it.
They'll be burying my son-in-law tomorrow. They'll bring him in a coffin. Cursed be the war.
So a generalized curse on the geopolitics that has led to private and personal misery for yet another Ukrainian family there, Wolf. But we also spoke to one man, and he repeated the sort of wider statement, a wider reaction to American and international help. Give us more weapons. This is what he said.
What do you think of Biden's visit to Kiev today? The American president is in Kiev meeting Zelensky right now.
It is for the best.
Do you have a message for him?
What would I tell the American president? Give us more weapon so we could kill all these orcs.
Now, of course, this area, Wolf, is being pounded, as I say. It's also an area that was liberated in September from the Russian invaders. And they're very, very anxious, both at the government level and at the local level, that this pounding they're getting from artillery is the precursor to a more wide and more aggressive Russian offensive, Wolf.
Just stay safe over there, Sam Kiley. Thank you very much for that report. Coming up, the secret and historic mission to put the President of the United States into an active war zone, a truly extraordinary risk for an American president. No major American military presence to watch his back, at least not now. How this day compares to the legacies of past American commanders-in-chief when our special report continues. You're in the Situation Room. President Biden's historic visit to Ukraine marked the first time an American commander-in-chief traveled into a war zone without a major U.S. military presence there to protect him. Our Brian Todd has been digging into previous presidential visits to war zones. So, Brian, how does a top-secret trip like this take shape?
Wolf, it involves meticulous planning done almost entirely in secret with complicated logistical arrangements and a little bit of faith that luck will carry them through.
It was at the height of World War II, and the conflict still wasn't going America's way. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt engaged in a high-stakes game of misdirection, tricking journalists into thinking he was taking a train to his home in upstate New York. But he secretly switched trains in Baltimore, headed to Miami, then took a series of arduous plane hops and ended up in Casablanca, Morocco. It was January 1943, the first time a sitting American president rode on an airplane. A trip shrouded in secrecy so that FDR could strategize with Winston Churchill, a journey fraught with danger.
In World War II, you not only had the possibility of the commander-in-chief being shot down, but the technology was such that air travel was not as safe in the 1940s as it is today.
Some U.S. troops in Morocco didn't know their president was coming until he rode past them in a Jeep. Historians say war zone trips for American presidents have always been complicated, even dating back to the Civil War.
At least 12 presidents have gone to war zones in the past, starting, of course, with Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War. There are those famous pictures of him in his top hat visiting Union soldiers to boost their morale. But it is a big risk.
Lyndon B. Johnson went twice as president, Richard Nixon once to Vietnam while the war there was raging.
I know when Nixon went in 1969 to Saigon, all of his advisors were saying, don't do it, it's too dangerous.
George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald Trump went to Iraq and Afghanistan to visit U.S. troops.
Islamists would have been very happy to assassinate George W. Bush or Barack Obama. And so when those presidents went to Kabul and Baghdad, respectively, they were taking huge risks.
When George H.W. Bush, as a former president, visited Kuwait in 1993, Saddam Hussein's intelligence service tried to have Iraqi operatives assassinate him, a plot that was narrowly foiled. Presidents have taken these risks to boost troops' morale, to strategize with other commanders, and sometimes to decide whether a war should even continue.
I shall go to Korea.
That was Dwight D. Eisenhower's objective as president-elect when he took a secret trip to South Korea in December 1952.
Eisenhower not only went to meet the troops, not only went to meet the South Korean leader, but actually took a plane over Chinese and North Korean positions to get a view himself of the nature of their defenses. That was an extremely hazardous trip.
Historian Tim Naftali says despite the sometimes incredible risks, the rewards are very high, that as commander-in-chief, it's crucial for a president to show their commitment to the fight and to show that not only to American forces, but also to their adversaries as well, Wolf.
Sends a powerful message indeed.
Yes.
President Abraham Lincoln, we're told, is thought to be the only American president to actually have come under fire at one point. Is that right?
That's right. The extraordinary moment there. July of 1864, Confederate troops were assaulting Fort Stevens right here within the Washington, D.C. boundaries. Lincoln goes out to see the battle. He looks over the top of the fortifications, and he almost gets hit with gunfire. The legend has it that a soldier told him, "Get down, you damn fool." But he came close that day to getting hit.
Interesting historic note. Thanks very much, Brian Todd, reporting for us. So we'll be right back with some important notes about a monumental day tomorrow. This is CNN's special coverage. A very big day tomorrow. Again, President Biden delivers a major speech from Poland, and Russian President Vladimir Putin gives his own speech just ahead of the one-year mark of this war. I'll be back tomorrow, of course, in the Situation Room, 6 p.m. Eastern, and I'll be back for another special edition of the Situation Room tomorrow night, 9 p.m. Eastern. Among other guests, we'll speak live with the former British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, who's visited Ukraine several times since the war began. And our own Christiane Amanpour will interview the Polish President, President Duda, on what he's pushing President Biden to do. Lots going on. We have a full special report coming up once again tomorrow night, 9 p.m. Eastern. To all of our viewers, thanks very much for watching. I'm Wolf Blitzer in the Situation Room. CNN Tonight with Allison Camerota starts right now.